interview with Captain F.R.T. Anderson, 21st of April, 1997. Captain Anderson, perhaps we could start by you telling us about when you first joined the RCN and your training either as a civilian or in the service before you became the project electrical engineer for VX-10 Squadron.
Oh my goodness, that gets me back to 1952, where I joined the RCN as so-called UNTD cadet, University Naval Training Divisions. To make the very long story short, brief, I graduated from the University of Toronto with BS in Electrical Engineering, whereupon, as usual on such occasions, I was sent to undergo a so-called long electrical course in HMCS Stadacona in Halifax. In due course, of course, next year, by 1957, I graduated from that course, and interestingly enough, I have indicated my interest in submarine service, so the RCN, in their wisdom, sent me instead to an air familiarization course in Wardidown, UK. Well, since I liked both air and ships, I didn't object at all, not that I had any choice, and I became what is popularly known, or at least it was then known, a SIGO, part of the Fleet Air Arm. In due course, in 1958, I became the air electrical officer for the brand new jet fighter squadron of the Navy's finest, VF-870. As you may know, Canadian Navy has just replaced an old piston aircraft, Sea Fury, with brand new jet. Well, actually, it wasn't brand new. It was used aircraft on the U.S. Navy, but we made it brand new. Then in 1959, having previously married my splendid wife, Andre, I was transferred to headquarters, where I worked as one of the staff electrical officers on the staff of Director of Aeronautical Engineering. It was actually known as Director of Aircraft Engineering. And I had responsibility for the development of sensors and avionics. Then, since I sort of pressed my masters to give me further education in fine matters of communications, electronics, avionics, I was sent to University of Toronto to do my masters of electrical engineering. The Navy, in their wisdom, gave me 2 years. Well, I have always tried to do better than I can, so I made it in 1 year with Class A honors. And not boasting, but it was sort of a unique achievement. It was particularly important, and I'm glad that I did it, although it took an enormous effort, because that enabled the Naval Headquarters in 1962 to send me to VX-10. And VX-10 was at the time involved in a number of very crucial trials. Some of them, of course, impinge directly on your interest. As far as the helicopter portion is concerned, we had trials involving the single sideband communications, brand new Doppler radar, which was navigation, cum autopilot stabilization. We had additional hold-down trials, which involved certain mating of the sensors and so on and so forth, and then the usual variety of research and development which such agencies as VX-10 are apt to do. That was absolutely fantastic. Now, I don't know if I need to go beyond, or would you like me to continue?
I have a couple of questions. Perhaps if we can go back for a moment or two. You had said that you were sent off to the UK for an aircraft familiarization course.
That was the usual practice, yes.
Now, would that have been for observer training?
No. Basically, what happened was that when we went through our long electrical course, this was familiarization with the surface Navy aspects. Then, since, in fact, the Navy, in their wisdom, obviously decided that I'm going to be part of an air fleet, they said, okay, we have to train you in matters which, addition to the surface familiarization, will make you expert, if one can make an expert in 4 months, in air matters. It involves such things as, for example, avionics, the little of which we had at the time, of course, basic aircraft behavior, basic aircraft maintenance procedures, and so on and so forth. And that enabled them to officially then classify me as air electrical officer. So I had really, although it was not called that in those days, full qualifications as electrical officer when I could be sent to any ship theoretically, and I had an additional qualification in air matters. So I was both electrical officer and air electrical officer, and that's why when I came back I was attached to VF 870 fighter squadron.
I see. Now, following your time with the fixed wing squadron, you said that you were at headquarters.
Yes.
On the staff of the Directorate of Aircraft Engineering.
That is correct.
During that time, which is prior to you being posted to VX-10, were you in your job responsible, or did you have any exposure to any of the RCN's early helicopter trials?
No, not as such.
Not as such.
I was aware of them, but I had no direct involvement, no.
All right. So we move forward then. You were posted to VX-10 in what year?
1962. During the Cuban crisis. Just to orient it historically.
Right. And you arrived on the ground in June or July of 1962?
I think it was really probably around Christmas, because I just finished my postgraduate studies. I think the convocation was sometimes in October, and after hard work I took a month off, which was unheard of. So by about November, end of November, December, I went and I joined VX-10. So it was probably end of 62.
So what would have been the first project that you would have been assigned to once you joined VX-10?
Well, actually, I was responsible for all avionics matters in VX-10 as VX-10 electrical officer, because we had an engineering officer. My colleague Peter Charlton was engineering officer. I was electrical officer. So theoretically, anything to do with electrical of any nature would automatically come under me. So theoretically, I was responsible for and involved in all the projects. Some of them were, of course, closer to my heart than others.
Right. So I assume that there would have been a number of projects that VX-10 would have been undertaking at that time.
Yeah. I would say, again, I'm quoting from memory, but for the sake of magnitude description, I would say we were involved in at least, say, dozen projects at any one time.
All right.
Some of them were sort of priority one, others were priority 12, and then, of course, it might have reversed. But it was roughly that number.
Just a little bit of a sideline here. You said that you were attached to some projects that were closer to your heart than others. Could you give me an example?
Yes. For example, we had a very interesting project in connection with CS2F modernization midlife program, which was to incorporate a good tactical navigation and plotting system capabilities, so that, for example, you could plot accurately the target position based on such things as explosive echo range, which is known as JULI. And that was particularly interesting to me because I felt that it was one weak link which we had in the aircraft as a total weapon system, which absolutely had to be improved. And as future showed, this indeed was the right thing to do. Then, of course, I was very much interested also in the brand new Doppler radar, which was at the sort of leading edge of technology, where with Marconi, Canadian Marconi, we were really developing something brand new. And that ultimately will have proven essential to the automatic control of the helicopter, particularly as it applies to the very critical phase of operations, which is transition from forward flight to hover.
All right. Just a couple of quick questions here. For anyone that's listening to this tape, where was Marconi located at that time?
In Montreal.
In Montreal.
Yes.
All right. Now, when you talk about the tactical plotting system for the Tracker aircraft, was that also installed in the Sea King helicopters later on?
Yes. In fact, a somewhat improved version was, in fact, installed in Sea King, and that was also a key component.
Now, obviously, at this time, 1962, VX-10 did not have any Sea King helicopters in the squadron. I think they arrived the following year, in fall of 1963.
Yeah.
So what sort of improvements was VX-10 working on? Because it does relate to the helicopters for the tactical plotting system.
Well, if you really look at the situation as it then existed, there were individual sensors and equipment, which is really nothing new except for a few things such as Marconi's Doppler radar. The problem is usually, and that is true to this very day, to take those individual input sensors, as we call them, whether it's magnetic anomaly detection or radar altimeter or Doppler radar or anything else you can think of, and making it work as a system, as a whole. Because very often, although it looks a simple thing to put something new and make it play, these days one finds out, and then it was also true, that the moment you introduce something else, it has many, many effects, some of them unforeseen. And that is the raison d'être for having VX-10, so we can find more about unknowns.
Now, with this tactical plotting system, it was a system that was originally designed by the Americans, the USN, if I remember correctly. What sort of improvements was VX-10 able to make to that system?
Okay. You are rightly referring to this particular plotting system, which had the very interesting acronym JSAP, for I think it was called Julie Automatic Plotting and Positioning System. Accuracy was issue number one, reliability was number two, and sort of cleanup of human engineering aspects, which was also important. So what we have really done, we did not develop it from zero. We have taken something which USN has in fact developed prior to that and abandoned as not being up to the latest state of the art. And we have reached the point where it actually worked very, very well in terms of reliability, in terms of accuracy, and in terms of ergonomics.
Were there any modifications that were required for this particular system to move it from carrying it aboard the tracker aircraft, which was certainly a larger aircraft in terms of the cabin, than opposed to a Sea King helicopter?
Yes and no. I know it might sound very ambiguous, but basically what happens is that virtually all of the equipment is built to certain standards, known as, in those days, was known as ARINC standards and ATR sizes. So in some cases it meant we had to find a new space for it, since virtually the overall size of the equipment itself was really non-changeable, because it would take too much of development and reproductionizing to make it fit into something smaller, because if you have a bigger hole than the item, it's not a problem, you put a plug. But our objective was, okay, this is the piece of equipment which we have. It has a given form fit and power requirements factor. Where can you find a space which logically it should be in and can be physically fitted? Although from the, say, scientific point of view, it's a trivial problem. In real terms of engineering and fitment and so on and so forth, it can be a big problem.
And would that, when you say that it could be a big problem, would that apply in the case of the Sea King helicopter that came?
Yes, all of them. In fact, I remember we had to completely reconfigure the CS2F when we went for what was then known as midlife modernization. Yeah.
All right. When you refer to, or when we look at the Sea King helicopter and VX-10's role in the trials, what would you consider the most important component or of the trials as it relates to air electrical engineering? I know the engineers were concerned with bear trap and the constant winch haul down system and those sorts of things. What was your concern as an electrical engineer?
Okay, this is an extremely difficult question to answer for the following reasons. When you go back to, let's say, 40s and very early 50s, you could take almost any piece of equipment, treat it as unique in its own, put it in, connect it, and make it play. After 1950s, systems began to be very highly integrated. Integrated to the point where you couldn't take one piece of equipment, plug it in, without realizing that it will have some effect somewhere. Even if you don't interconnect it with other inputs, which normally you do, like in a tactical system, you might have an input from Sonoboy, input from radar, input from MAD, you know all the acronyms, so I won't repeat them.
Right.
How do you make sure that they all run? Even if that was not a problem, you can't just put in a new piece of equipment because you might find out that now you don't have enough power. And this is a major problem. So I would say that this can be, in my mind, I'm looking for a very quick, good analogy, it's like a human body. And I would say, well, okay, which is more important, kidneys, liver, heart, brain? I don't know. But what I can tell is that depending on the circumstances, certain things become priority one, while something else may be priority two. Like, for example, at one stage I remember very vividly, there were a couple of occasions where when you were transmitting on SSB, because the set had fairly high power, an antenna was very close to the fuselage, not only did you have the interference and compatibility problems, at one stage there was in fact a high possibility of this arcing over and starting fire. So of course, fire on an aircraft is not a very pleasant thing, so we dropped everything else and were told, solve that problem. So, you know, from the overall point of view, was it important? Probably not so much, but because of the perception at that time that, yes, we are facing a possible hazard, that became top priority.
Now, with that communication system, was that VHF or UHF?
That was VHF. We also had a UHF, but UHF was not a problem. VHF was a problem because it required bigger antennas, and of course, you didn't have much real estate, to use the expression which we used at the time, to put it on, and it might interfere with something else. And remember, when you have rotary wings, which is the blades of the helicopter rotating around and swinging and moving every which way, you want to make sure that at one stage you don't strike the wire.
Now, SSB, that's single
sideband.
Now, what was unique about that at the time?
The unique thing about it was to, in fact, find the spot for it in the aircraft, because physically it was fairly large. In particular, in addition to the basic radio, there was, in fact, the antenna tuning and coupler unit, which is almost as big as a radio. So you had to find a place for that. And because you were working with high frequencies and high powers, it wasn't just a matter of finding an appropriate hole to fit it in. You had to make sure that you had some space around that hole so it won't arc over. And when you finally solved all that, you had to get the signal out through an antenna. And of course, preferably, the antenna should be on the outside of an aircraft rather than on the inside, where it would be shielded. Where do you put it? Because there are other antennas and other sensors.
So where would that antenna have been finally located on the Seeking helicopter?
Oh, it was finally located on the fuselage, where we chose a certain real estate because you had to have a minimum length for it to become an antenna, and ultimately it was solved.
Now, when you're talking about the installation of the SSB, are the electrical engineers working closely with the pilot and co-pilot and sonarman in order to locate pieces of equipment in certain locations?
Yes, well, it is a team effort. For example, basically, and I'm making a very long and complex story very short. As electrical officer, of course, I had a reasonable idea of the electrical characteristics, requirements, and so on and so forth. Then, of course, I also had to keep track of, is it likely to interfere signal-wise with something else because there is radiation present. Today we'll call it electromagnetic interference. It was a big issue because you don't want, when you are transmitting, to have an effect in autopilot. And that's exactly the first thing you find out, that when it begins to transmit, something funny is happening to the autopilot.
Was that one of the problems?
Well, that was one of the problems which ultimately we solved. You know, nothing major, nothing unsafe, but the point is, you can't do something with impunity. You always have to think, what else will it do to the rest of the system? Then you had to say, okay, where can we put the fittings? Fittings of the equipment itself, radio, the tuner. Where do we punch the skin of an aircraft? Because you don't want to do it in a place which has critical stresses, and so on and so forth. Well, because of the sharing and division of responsibilities, sharing of the responsibility to the extent that we all had to make sure that works, and division of responsibilities in the sense that I'm responsible for electrical things, but I must be aware of electrical environment in an aircraft, and engineering officer's responsibility is to make sure that we don't do something which affects the airframe integrity. And I would sit down with my colleagues, Peter Charlton, say, okay, well, you can't put it in here because of that. However, would that space be fine? Well, no, you can't use that space because that's too close to my other sensors. And eventually you will find a reasonable compromise. Then, of course, you go and install it and try it. And if it's not good, you start all over again.
So would for Peter Charlton's side, or the engineer side, would that be something that would have been administered by the Directorate of Aircraft Engineering that would have been responsible for the airframe and engines and that sort of
thing?
That
is correct.
All right. And there was also the avionics side.
Yeah, which was my colleague at the time, well, my superior commander, Hank Isaac. Very nice person.
And he would have been at headquarters in Ottawa.
That's right.
All right. Now, I assume that when the Sea Kings would have arrived from the manufacturer, which was Sikorsky, they would have been outfitted with the VHF, but apparently that's not the case. Is that correct?
As I recall it, that is correct. They were primarily UHF equipped, which was a sort of standard aircraft configuration, and they had sufficient instrumentation and other sensors to enable it to function. Like, for example, they had the sonar, because that was the main raison d'etre of seeking.
Right.
But again, things have changed to the extent that because of our hold-down necessity, for which originally seeking helicopter was not configured, we had to relocate the winches, we had to relocate the sonar to make room for the winching system.
Oh.
Which was became known as the bear trap.
So that would have meant that this console for the sonar operator and the chair and everything would have been moved in the cabin in order to make room for?
Not so much the actual display and the human-machine interface, including operator. It was the actual location of the winching system, which, of course, we had to find the space for. And again, this is perhaps a good examination of the complexity of the issues. Because, as it turned out, ultimately, you were winching the helicopter down, and the helicopter was not neutral. In fact, the helicopter, on the average, would have about 2,000 pounds of lift. And the big winching system on the ship had to, in fact, overpower it, which is a completely different concept from anybody else. And that was absolutely necessary to make sure that you have a stable helicopter, because we found out that if you didn't do that, and if you had almost, say, neutral helicopter floating about, and that was a typical problem in the Royal Navy, once it got into oscillatory motion, which you are likely to get into when the ship's deck is heaving and turning and heeling, those oscillations become divergent. And at that stage you have two choices. Either you cut your lines and get the heck out of there, or else you go down into the drink. And we ultimately found out through trials that if you put something in the order of 2,000 pounds of downward pressure, which means that the aircraft helicopter had to have about 2,000 pounds of lift, it was reasonably stable, so much so that even if you induced an oscillation, it would be dampened oscillation. So instead of increasing in oscillatory motion, it would decrease. And that's what made it possible. So this is a typical, you know, complex issue once you get into it. Now, if you have something which has to stand a minimum of 2,000 pounds of constant hold down, you want to make sure that not only that your structure, the winching system, is sufficiently strong to be able to do it, and more importantly, the ultimate probe, which is mated to the fuselage, is strong enough to take that type of a force with few G's on top of that. And if you happen to have, say, a shock of, let's say, 2.5-3 G's, then you are talking not about 2,000 pounds, but you are talking about 6,000 pounds, right?
Right.
So you have to make sure that it is properly mounted in the proper area which can take the stress, because you don't want that probe to sort of wreck your fuselage.
So that would have been one of the areas that Peter Charlton would have been responsible for.
Exactly.
All right. If we can just go back to the communication issue for a moment. What would have been the increased benefits using VHF as opposed to UHF in terms of ranges? I assume would be one of the main considerations.
Yeah, that was in fact the primary consideration, because UHF has much shorter range. Now, in the case of an aircraft which, say, flies at 40,000 feet, you have fairly decent range. On the other hand, when the helicopter is hovering 50 feet above the water, with UHF, you've got very, very limited range. On the other hand, VHF, very high frequency, which is usually called or in the order of anything over 5 to 30 megacycles, it has the capability of much greater range. Not only that, what is important that with VHF, you can use the ionospheric bouncing principle. So you can choose an appropriate frequency to a particular time of a day and particular ionospheric conditions. So theoretically, under optimum conditions, you can communicate over literally thousands of miles.
By bouncing the signal.
Exactly.
And if you know the conditions that are required and you use the right frequency, you can increase
that range.
That's right. If you don't have those sort of atmospheric conditions, what would be the sort of normal range for VHF for a Sea King helicopter, which is operating 50 feet off the deck?
Yeah. Well, let me put it this way. It's not a sort of yes or no, you have or you haven't got the right conditions. There is always a particular frequency which gives you greater range than other ranges. But if I am to make a general statement, which normally I would be a little reluctant to do, because you can always scientifically prove me that at that particular point in space and those conditions, you can't have that, I will say that we were talking about a range of hundreds to thousands of miles. And I am saying is, you could always assume that within the total spectrum of VHF coverage, there's always a portion, which is just fine. The trick was to find the portion, but there were means of doing that.
So this communication we're using the VHF is one very important component as it relates to keeping the ship in contact with the Sea King helicopter.
That is correct.
But another equally important component would have been contact between the ship and the Sea King helicopter through radar.
Yes.
Now, when a Sea King helicopter is operating at 50 feet off the water or 200 feet off the water as it comes into the hover in the transition stage, I remember reading that some of the Sperry radar that was available at the time had difficulty tracking the Sea King in ranges over 7 to 21 miles, which is not very far out given the endurance of that particular aircraft.
Yes. And again, you see, it often depends very much on the environmental conditions. Let me explain. If you have a perfectly smooth sea, which you might have in the tropics, you know, in harsh latitudes, then radar has much greater ranges because you don't have the noise and the radar clutter, as it is known. On the other hand, if you are in the North Atlantic, where we had the primary responsibilities, there are very, very few times when you have nice smooth sea. Usually it's full of waves and crests and everything else. And under those conditions, you get radar reflections from that, which creates what is generally speaking known as radar clutter. Then trying to distinguish a very small, tiny pinhole of a signal represented by helicopter amongst all that clutter is difficult. So that is the problem. How do you readily identify that? And this is why in a helicopter is particularly difficult because you are very close to the surface of the water.
Now that would have been shipborne radar that we're talking about in this particular instance. Radar was equally important for the Sea King helicopter, and before we turned on the tape, you were talking about your involvement with Doppler radar for the Sea King helicopters. I'm wondering if you can explain what your role was as it related to that particular VX-10 project.
Okay. This, of course, is just one of the projects. And again, at one particular point in time, that became more interesting and more important than others. So, of course, I switched my attention 90% to that Doppler radar as opposed to something else. The Doppler radar, which was developed in conjunction with Canadian Marconi in Montreal, who actually produced and developed that hardware, was primarily utilized as a navigation and control device. Navigation to enable you to get from point A to B, because Doppler radar was one of the good sensors. As a matter of fact, in that particular period of time, there was a general rivalry in the industry and the services, for that matter, between inertial navigation and Doppler navigation. Today, of course, we use both.
Now, what is the difference between those two types of radars?
Okay, Doppler radar is simply a device which sends out a series of pulses through a appropriately configured antenna which makes it into a beam like a searchlight, and you receive back energy from that reflected from the surface over which you are flying. If you have a relative motion between your antenna and the surface over which you are flying, you get a so-called Doppler effect, which is merely change in the frequency of the original signal, which you can then measure. And there is a relationship between the speed of the motion and the frequency. So that, in fact, you can say, if your frequency has shifted by that much, you are going at such and such a speed, and if you integrate that, you can say you have gone that far.
All right, we'll just stop the tape here and we'll turn it over.